Hi, this is Perry, and you're listening to the Chemist's Corner podcast for Monday, September 27, 2010. Welcome to Chemist Corner. I'm your host, Perry Romanowski, writer, juggling runner, and according to Google, the most famous cosmetic chemist. Of course, Google also says I'm the funniest looking cosmetic chemist, so I don't know how much stock I put in that search engine. Chemist Corner is a podcast about cosmetic science and is broadcast to help educate, entertain, and inspire current and future cosmetic scientists. The information and opinions discussed on Chemist Corner are those of the hosts and the guests alone. They do not necessarily reflect those of any past, present, or future employers. Well, we've got an excellent show for you today. As always, we're going to talk about some cosmetic science news. Then we're going to talk about stability testing of cosmetic products. We'll have an interview with UK cosmetic chemist Colin Saunders. And finally, we'll end with an innovation exercise. Before we get to the news, I want to remind everyone that the Complete Cosmetic Chemist Training Program has opened up for new students. You can go to chemistcorner.com website for more details on how you can join the program. Feel free to leave a comment on the blog if you have any questions. We've got a lot of students in there, and people that want to know about the ins and out of cosmetic formulating are finding the program quite useful. Now, some cosmetic industry news. Cosmetics Designs reports on a survey commissioned by Neutrogena in which women said it was more important for cosmetic products to improve the condition of their skin and protect it from sun than it was to come up with new colors. According to the report, more than anything, women wanted their cosmetic products to deliver flawless skin tone and to minimize the look of fine lines and wrinkles. The survey also showed that women are well aware of the negative effects of UV rays on skin. Over 55% of women wear makeup with SPF. Almost half the women in the survey also said that if they were pressed for time, they would choose applying makeup over eating breakfast. This didn't seem surprising to me, though. It's very rare the woman who would go out of the house without putting makeup on. So what does this all mean for cosmetic chemists? Well, when you are creating skin products, be sure to include some kind of ingredient that helps improve skin tone, or at the very least allows you to make a claim that it will. When creating makeup, you'll be at a competitive disadvantage if you don't include something in which you can make SPF claim too. This might require additional testing, but in the competitive world of the cosmetic industry, it will probably be worth it. You can read the entire story by following the link we put on the blog. In this next story, I thought this is a bit of interesting news. According to a report, Panasonic has invented a 16-finger hair-washing robot. The way it works is that you sit in a chair like at a beauty salon and you place your head back in a bowl that contains the water, shampoo, and robot fingers. Sensors measure and remember the shape of your head, so every time you use it, the robot will remember you and wash your hair the same way. So the fingers put the product on your hair, and then it rubs the product through your hair, and then it rinses it. And all this happens automatically. It is due to be unveiled at the International Home Care and Rehabilitation Exhibition in Tokyo at the end of this month, September 2010. I remember when I was formulating hair products, it was always a dream of mine to one day see robots that could take care of the entire process. This robot here that's been invented by Panasonic is a good step in that direction. If only they could create one that could also cut hair, too. We could have salons in everybody's house. Something to think about is how this might affect the formulation of hair products. For example, you probably don't have to create a shampoo that makes much foam because in this robotic system, it would be better to wash hair without foam. Foam isn't necessary for cleansing products, and when there is no human involved in the process, foam pretty much becomes unnecessary. So what would your cleansing products look like if they didn't have to foam? This is a great exercise for all cosmetic chemists to do. Just imagine if some significant change happened to your market, then imagine how your products would be different. Our final bit of cosmetic industry news is that my old company, Alberto Culver, just was announced that they were being acquired by Unilever. Unilever is a huge company compared to Alberto Culver, on the order of, you know, 10 times the size. And they are famous for brands like Dove and Axe and Suave. And now they're going to pick up Alberto Culver's brand, Tresemme VO5. It's pretty rare that these huge acquisitions happen in the industry. Although the rumors about Alberto Culver being picked up or bought up by somebody else have been going around for years. When I was there, probably since 1996, there was rumors about someone acquiring Alberto Culver. So I'm a little surprised that it happened, but not completely. What this really means, though, for cosmetic chemists is that you have to remember that who you're working for. When you work as a cosmetic chemist, you have a skill that a company is going to want to use. And when you get hired, just remember, even though somebody pays your paycheck, you always have to be working on yourself. You should always keep an updated resume and always be looking for different opportunities that might help you advance the goals that you're trying to achieve. Gone are the days when people can simply go to a company and spend their entire career there and then retire and do whatever they like. No, you have to be constantly working on yourself, learning new things. A training program like the one we have, or the continuing education courses through the Society of Cosmetic Chemists, are always important, not just for on the job, but for your future career. Because you never know when one company is going to buy another company and your job might be gone, or you might get transferred to somewhere else. So I encourage all cosmetic chemists, no matter where you're at, to always be working on yourself, always be learning something new, and always keep your resume updated. The biggest difference between what you experience in your college organic chemistry lab versus a cosmetic formulation lab is this. In an organic lab, you mix chemicals together and you hope something happens. Ideally, you get a chemical reaction that you expect. As a formulating chemist, you mix chemicals together and hope nothing happens. Cosmetics are mixtures of chemicals that mostly aren't supposed to react with each other. Unfortunately, they often do react or otherwise change, so you need to test your formulas to see how long they'll last. This is called stability testing, and is something a cosmetic scientist spends much of her time doing. We're going to talk briefly about what a stability test is, how you do it, and why and when you should do it. In the simplest case, stability testing is just an experiment in which you create a batch of your formula and you put the samples at different environmental conditions for a set period of time. These conditions vary in temperature and in light levels and are meant to simulate what will happen to your product during its life cycle. At specific intervals, you evaluate your samples for various physical, chemical, and performance characteristics to see how they have changed. If the changes are minimal according to your company's standards, then your formula is said to have passed stability testing. This means you can have confidence that when your formula is shipped to stores and ultimately consumers, it will still be as good as when it was first manufactured. The underlying assumption in stability testing is that increasing storage temperature speeds up the aging process. A handy rule of thumb that we follow in the cosmetic industry is that a sample stored at 45°C for 8 weeks is equivalent to one that is stored at room temperature for 1 year. This isn't an exact predictor, of course, but it's good enough for the purposes of cosmetic products. When do you perform a stability testing? Since you're making hundreds of thousands of prototypes, hopefully, during your career, it won't be practical to run stability tests on it all. So you'll want to minimize the number of stability tests you have to do. So here are just a few times when you want to do stability testing. Whenever you're creating new prototypes and you're satisfied with the way one of them performs, then you should do a quick stability test. Now, this would include just putting a sample at 45°C and one at room temperature and comparing how they perform over a couple of weeks. And this will just let you know right away whether your product is going to separate or otherwise need some extra work. Whenever you're doing new raw materials, you should also do stability testing, because any new raw material you use, such as a fragrance or color change, can actually affect the stability of the product. When you try a new manufacturing procedure, this should also require stability testing, because manufacturing people are always trying to find faster ways to make formulas. And while this can often have no effect, it can also have some effect on stability. So you should run stability testing whenever you change a manufacturing procedure. And finally, you should do stability testing whenever you're using new packaging. Formulas, cosmetic formulas, can interact with packaging, and they can just behave differently. So you need to do a stability test in the packaging to see if it'll behave differently. The basic format for stability testing isn't set out in any sort of specific guidelines by the FDA or really any other group. But in general, you can follow a basic format for stability testing like this. In step one, you create your batch. So your batch is going to have to cover the number of stability samples that you have, and it's a good idea to make, say, 30 to 40% more than you think you'll need, just for spillage and things. Next, you want to fill your samples in glass jars and also the appropriate packaging. Really, being able to do both glass and final packaging is really a key to doing stability testing. You should also have a minimum of 2 samples for each storage condition. That way, if something happens to one, you still have a sample, and it also allows you to take samples out and put them back. You need to put samples at different conditions. So some different conditions you might consider, 50C, 45C, 37C, room temperature, and then a refrigerated one, say 4C. There's also a thing called freeze-thaw testing, which involves freezing the samples for 24 hours, then thawing them out, then heating them up, and doing that through a few cycles. And if you do that and your product stays together, that means you have a pretty stable formula. After you put up the samples, then you have to evaluate them over a set amount of times. Usually 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 8 weeks, 12 weeks, and 1 year are good stability intervals to test. You should also determine whether something is stable. So you have to decide at some point whether your formula is stable. In general, if after 8 weeks you've done testing and the formula has stayed together, you could feel pretty confident that you're going to have a stable product. Now, this isn't a guarantee, because sometimes things happen in 6 months that don't happen in 2 months. But in general, if something lasts at high temperature for 8 weeks, it's going to last for the length of time that a consumer will use the product. Early in your career, stability testing will be one of the most common activities you'll do. Now, if you create a system that you consistently follow, you'll avoid burnout and be able to confidently communicate when a product is appropriate to launch. Marketing people will always want you to tell them that the product is stable. And if you follow a good stability testing protocol, you can ensure that it is. We have today with us Colin Saunders. He's a UK-based formulator of cosmetic and topical pharmaceuticals for the last 27 years. Over that time, he has formulated nearly every category of product, including shampoos, cosmetic skin creams, pharmaceutical skin creams, face masks, lip balms, and much more. He has been an active member of the Society of Cosmetic Scientists since 1985, and in 1999 organized the first of the Formulate shows. His degree is in environmental science, and he continues to take a keen interest in the impact of human activities on the planet. He regards himself as an environmental activist and all-around greenie. When not in the lab, he writes a blog, Colin's Beauty Pages, with the intention of entertaining and hopefully informing users of cosmetic and personal care products. Welcome to the program, Colin.
Hi. Nice to speak to you, Perry.
You too. It's really great to speak to you after all this time. I've been a big fan of your blog, followed it for the last year or so. And I always enjoyed your contributions to the discussions on LinkedIn. So we had you on the program today to just find out about how you became a cosmetic scientist, and then maybe ask you a little bit about the business of blogging as a cosmetic scientist. So if we could just get started, how did you get started in the industry of cosmetics?
Well, my very first job was working as a quality control technician in a company that was then called Beecham's, and it's now later become a Glaxo, doing routine analysis of penicillin. And it was so boring. I've never had such a boring job in my life. And it almost put me off lab work altogether. So I decided that I was going to, this sounds very silly and naive now as a 50-year-old guy, but back then when I was about 18, I came to the conclusion that big chemical companies like Glaxo were destroying the planet. And I would go off and get a degree in environmental science and save the world from them.
And did you have you saved the world?
Not as such. But there was a very interesting snippet of information came to light while I was there. The factory was on the south coast of England, and in 1969, all the lobsters from where the chemical plant was upstream. The Gulf Stream pushes water from the Atlantic up through the channel, all died off, and that was just the time that they opened the biggest section of this plant. So I'd concluded that the place I was working for was killing lobsters, and I was going to go and find out all about it. By the time I'd got my environmental science degree, I'd become a bit more realistic about the way the world worked and realised it was highly unlikely that this coincidence was in actual fact anything to do with it. And also all the lobsters started growing back again as well, of their own accord without any help from me. So I sort of realized that maybe my sort of simple-minded approach to life wasn't as realistic as I'd thought at the time. But I had ended up with a degree in environmental science. The other thing that happened while I was getting it was there was a huge recession in the UK and there were no jobs at all for anybody. So my idea of getting a job as an environmental scientist was a bit tricky, and so I just walked down the road from where I lived and called into a few places to see if there were any jobs going, and there was a soap factory there, and they hired me on the basis I think I was the only person they'd ever seen with a degree. So that's how I got into cosmetic science. I had no intention of doing that. It wasn't remotely anything on my agenda, but I was well needed a job, and that was the first one I found.
Did you start off as a formulator, or are you just the chemist who did everything?
It was doing everything. It was a relatively small place, and basically they had a lab with three or four of us in it, and we did everything. So we'd do quality control, we'd do formulation development, we'd occasionally go and give presentations to customers, and it was quite a good basic grounding, because you saw the whole business right from the front end down to the back end. But I think one of the great things about being a sort of scientist in industry is you do get to talk to everybody. The people on the shop floor don't regard you as the bosses, and the senior management are quite happy to come and talk to you as well. So you sort of see everybody's views and hear everybody's opinions, which is can be quite entertaining because it's interesting how different people see the same things in different ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, how would you say you went about learning to formulate?
Well, it was pretty much like being thrown into a swimming pool at the deep end. I think I'd been there a week, and I'd sort of found out where the loos were and located which drawers the burettes were kept in. And we had a customer came in who wanted a whole range of products developed, and he had an interesting idea. He wanted them to be colour free and fragrance free, and all the managers regarded him as insane, and that he would sort of lose his shirt. And his brand was called Simple, which has subsequently gone on to become a multi-million pound brand. I don't know how big it is in the US, but it's certainly sort of one of the five or six big brands in the UK. I don't think anything I did is still on sale, apart from the soap, because Simple soap, as I'm sure you can imagine, a soap without any colour or fragrance, it's not really much you can do with that, really. It's just soap. So that one took half an hour, I think. It's probably relative to the amount of work I put into it, is probably the biggest selling product I've ever done.
Now you moved on to different jobs and had to start doing other types of formulation.
That's right, yes. I went on from there to do pharmaceutical products, which was they were topical pharmaceuticals, so they were quite similar in many ways to cosmetics, but the whole philosophy is different. you've got to get a product license. So whereas, as you know, if you develop a cosmetic product, you have to get it assessed for safety by a suitably qualified person, but it's not formally approved. You can just release it without having to get any actual permission from anybody. Whereas with a pharmaceutical, you have to justify everything you do. So the whole psychology is different. You have to sort of spend a long time getting a dossier together. And then these dossiers are quite extensive. I remember there was one we did for France, which actually filled an entire pallet.
Wow.
of papers, because the French, being the French, wanted individual copies of every single document involved in the application. They didn't actually want any more data. They just wanted copies of it all. So although it was, in that case, we had to remember it going in the van, actually. It was sort of put on a forklift truck and plonked into the van and driven off to France on a ferry. the same amount of data is required for all registration authorities around the world. So we would have the equivalent of a pallet of data for every product we developed. So it's not surprising that it would take sort of 4 or 5 years to do a pharmaceutical shampoo or a new cream with an active in.
And with the new regulations in Europe, that sort of is becoming more commonplace for cosmetics too.
Yes, I think though there's always a big psychological difference between being able to do something and the onus on the authorities being to say you've got it wrong and positively asking someone to give approval. If you put yourself in the regulator's point of view, you know, if you're regulating cosmetics, there's God knows how many thousands of cosmetics on the shelf, and if you hear there's a sort of anomaly with one of them, I think you would think carefully before you went through the process of taking it off the market. And you would have to justify why you were taking it off the market, whereas with pharmaceuticals, the person giving you the authorization has to justify why he let you put it on the market. So I think even if the regulations were the same for pharmaceuticals and cosmetics, it would still be a big difference if you've actually got to get formal approval or not. And of course, there's no way you could possibly have formal approval for every cosmetic product on the market, because there are just so many of them. The FDA would have to sort of take over half of Washington if they wanted to regulate cosmetics in the way that pharmaceuticals are regulated. And then I think that's fair enough, because pharmaceuticals are often got things in that are quite dangerous if they're not handled correctly. Whereas, as we know, cosmetics are pretty safe things. I think even the level of regulation we've got in Europe at the moment is probably far more than you really need to ensure the products are safe. I don't know about the States. We certainly don't have wards in hospitals over here for cosmetic victims. We had a talk by the Poison Centre, which is the government body who looks out for people who have severe reactions to things. And I think it was back in 97, so it may have changed since, but at that stage, with records going back to the 1950s, they only had one recorded fatality from a cosmetic, and that was an intravenous drug user who'd read that there was alcohol in his antiperspirant and wrenched the ball out of the pack and drunk it.
Oh, geez.
Obviously, that was quite a lot of aluminium to go into someone whose body was probably already compromised by sort of taking a cocktail of illicit drugs as well, and he actually died.
Yeah, in the United States here, cosmetics do not, there don't seem to be a lot of cosmetic injuries either. So they seem to be relatively safe.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, that particular case, it's very easy to imagine that it wasn't actually the underarm deodorant that he drank that killed him, because there were other complicating issues. There aren't that many products where you can say there has not been a single, well, there's only one fatality over several decades. It certainly wouldn't be true of cars. It wouldn't be true of toasters, I don't suppose. I mean, it's probably not even true of computers and things like that. They really are inherently very safe category of product, really.
Yeah, but people seem to be afraid of chemicals.
Yes, it's interesting that, isn't it?
Yeah. Getting back to the cosmetic job that you're doing, what did you find that you liked most about working on the job? You had mentioned that in your quality control area, it was kind of boring, but what appeals to you about formulating?
I think the difference is being a quality control technician is the same as lots of jobs. You're doing a little bit of a big process, but you don't actually see what's going on. What I think is great about being a cosmetic chemist is, you follow the thing through. It starts off either somebody else's idea or occasionally your own idea. You go in the lab, you start working on it, you see it taking shape. And then in all the jobs I've had, I've always followed it right through to production. So you're supervising the first couple of production batches being made and seeing it rolling down the production line. And it's a very complete process, and I think it's very satisfying to do that. And in the modern world, very few people have the chance to do anything that sort of creative and very real. Obviously, artists can paint paintings and things like that, but it seems to me that being a product development person, you're actually creating things that are going into people's lives, and you've seen the whole process all the way through. And I sort of feel like it's almost got a sort of medieval craft aspect to it, in that you're quite a lot of the time you're using sort of very basic hands-on things. I mean, you're in the lab stirring things, you're checking colors by eye, you're smelling it to see if it smells okay. You're generally It's a very, very real experience. And when you've formulated a product, you definitely feel it's your product. You don't sort of feel like you've just been paid to spend 8 hours, screwing a rivet in or filling in a form or whatever. I get a real sort of sense that I'm doing something that's a real job.
Yeah, that's the same sense I get, and I always liked keeping a notebook. There's something about having a notebook and just having that creation.
Yeah, I think the notebook's a big thing actually, because I've been doing this job for quite a while now, and I have many, many notebooks. They're all hard backed. And every piece of work I've done, I've written in hand in ink on paper. I've started sort of using the computer to write notes and put those in my lab book a bit more now. But I print them out and stick them in with glue. I don't sort of have any kind of virtual records. Everything is in the form of cellulose between hardback books. And I think that's sort of part of the satisfaction of the job. You've got a book that's got a continuous sort of story of what you've been doing. And so I think it's very, very rare. Very, 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 very few people have the chance to do that.
I agree. It's one of my favorite parts. And speaking of keeping notes, I want to move on to your beauty blog. As you know, there are hundreds of thousands of beauty blogs probably out there, but there are only a few written by cosmetic chemists, and yours was one of the few that I found. So I was just wondering how you got started with the beauty blogging business.
Well, it was sort of like several things in my career. It sort of just kind of happened without me really planning it. I was invited to give a talk to the Institute of Biology on how cosmetics worked, which I sort of spent a long time preparing for that. And I thought this is a very interesting opportunity to explain my business to sort of people who are scientists, who therefore be sort of quite interested and well informed, but nonetheless wouldn't know anything about what I did. So it sounded quite an interesting talk to give, and I spent quite a long time getting notes and things together. And then right at the last minute, they decided that by one of these amazing coincidences, the Institute of Biology were meeting the same night as the Society of Cosmetic Scientists were in the same town, and they decided to amalgamate the meetings. So about 12 hours before I was due to give this talk, I was suddenly presented with the fact that I wasn't going to be talking to people who knew nothing about cosmetics. Half the audience were going to be people who knew quite a lot about cosmetics. So I drastically rewrote it. And in fact, it wasn't a very successful talk, actually, because I was sort of composing it in my head in the car driving up to give it. But I had then a huge pile of notes. So I thought what I'd do is start a web page, which is why it's called Connie's Beauty Pages, not Connie's Beauty Blog. So the idea was I'll just creep stairs, tidy up these notes and stick them on the web as a web page and see what happens. And the answer was nothing much happened. And I fiddled around with them for a while. And I came across a blog called Life Hacker, which is, I think, quite a big blog in the sort of tech world. I like the way they laid it out, and I tried to sort of rearrange my web page to make it look more like Lifehacker, which gave it the sort of blog structure. So from there on, I started blogging. I mean, for a long, long time, nobody was reading it. The only person who was reading it was my mum. And it actually almost, if you trawl right back, A, you'll find some notes which sound a bit like they were prepared for giving a speech, and other bits which are just rambling because I was sort of jotting stuff down, not imagining anybody would ever read it. In fact, in for most of the old stuff, nobody has ever read it. A lot of the early pages have never been visited by anybody. So basically, it just took on a life of its own, really. I think it's quite therapeutic sometimes to sit down and think about trying to explain something that you know very well to somebody who wouldn't know anything at all about it, not even from first principles. I always have a sort of vision in my mind of my reader being a sort of 35-year-old woman who might be, sort of a journalist or an accountant or something like that, who's, quite intelligent and aware and very well informed, but knows nothing at all about science. So I've got to try and write it in such a way that somebody who hasn't got a science degree would understand it. And I mean, it's up to readers whether they think I succeeded or not, but that's what I'm always trying to do.
Yeah, that's what I really like about it. You do make more complicated subjects easily attainable to most people.
Well, I hope so. That's the intention.
How would you say that you've benefited as a cosmetic chemist? Has your blogging helped you at all?
Well, I think it's helped in a number of ways. I mean, for a start, I wouldn't be talking to you if it weren't for it.
That is true.
So I think it's one way of getting to know people you wouldn't otherwise know, which is usually a good thing. The other thing is, I think the intellectual exercise of trying to write something down on a blog, I think, helps you understand it yourself. One of the jobs I've had over the years is we used to assess new product ideas when I was at the pharmaceutical company, and every month we'd get people turning up to pitch their ideas, some of which were very, very scientific indeed. And it was very noticeable that the people who really understood what they were doing could explain what their idea was in ordinary language if they had to. Not all the people assessing the ideas were scientists, and quite often, we'd stop them and ask them to explain something in plain language. If they couldn't explain it in plain language, and then we probed them a bit more, it often became clear that they couldn't explain it in plain language because they couldn't explain it in any language. And I think it's sort of that was quite an eye-opener, really. And I think things like I did 8 blog posts on parabens a while back,
Yes.
and really, if you look at the traffic, I mean, it's totally left my readers cold. They really haven't been following me on the parabens thing at all. But it really helped me understand what I thought about them and where I thought the actual issues were with it.
It does seem like just writing about a topic does sort of help give you a better understanding of it. The last topic I wanted to talk about with you was the Society of Cosmetic Scientists, as it is out there in the UK. How has that helped you in your career?
Well, it's hugely helpful to know other people doing the same job as yourself when you're doing such an unusual job. I mean, no doubt if you're an accountant or a lawyer, there's plenty of other people in your town who do the same job as you and who you can sort of relate to. But I think there's about 400 or 500 cosmetic chemists in the UK. So, you don't run into them very often. And I think sort of, be able to be as part of a community of cosmetic chemists is very, very helpful. And the other thing is, it's very, very helpful to be sort of involved with the educational side of things, going to lectures and hearing people talk about things and just keeping on top of what's going on.
Are the meetings local around London?
Well, they're generally in London, but if you look at the map of the UK, London, I mean, London is the biggest city by far in the UK, and most people live close enough to London to get into it, and all the trains run into London, the roads are designed to get you to London. So if something's in London, basically most people can get to it. But they do have them in other parts of the country as well. But I live near enough London that London's the place for it. But it's also the fact that you sort of have a sort of camaraderie with other members as well. So when you go onto LinkedIn, you see Dean Godfrey on there, you sort of feel you're in a place where you know somebody, which is quite nice.
Yeah, sure. What was this Formulate show that you organized?
Well, that was something. Dean went over to the States and saw some of the Society of Cosmetic Chemists did called a Suppliers Days.
Okay, so that's your version of Suppliers Day out in the UK.
Yeah, we the Dean's idea was to simply transfer, you know, the supplier day to the UK. But when we looked at it, the fact is, you know, the UK is a much smaller place, and you know, we didn't think that there was a big enough number of suppliers just in the UK to justify doing it. But if we opened it up to other European suppliers, which is what we really wanted to do, we didn't think they'd want to come to the UK just for a day. So we turned it into a 2-day event, and as soon as it becomes a 2-day event, then you're looking at having a sort of social event in the evening as well. And so it turned into quite a different thing by the time we finished it. But originally, it was simply supposed to be a Society of Cosmetic Chemists Suppliers Day. We just adapted it until it didn't look anything like it anymore.
Is that an event that continues on today?
Yes, it's probably the biggest event in the cosmetic calendar for most people. I meet no end of people who go to Formulae who don't go to In Cosmetics, and you know, that's their one big show of the year. So yeah, it's about twice the size of the first one now. There's usually about 1,000 people attend it. Because we were doing a 2-day event, we thought we needed something to make it more of a draw than a suppliers day, so we put on an educational program, and that's become a very, very big deal indeed now. So
If you want to get in contact with Colin, you can visit his beauty pages at colinsbeautypages.co.uk. We'll have a link to that in the on the blog. Well, thank you for joining us today, Colin, and hope you have fun out there formulating in the UK.
thanks, and thanks for inviting me. It was a pleasure.
The Innovative Cosmetic Chemist. Inspired by today's robot hair washing device, I thought it would be a good opportunity to help you start thinking more innovative. One of the best ways to come up with innovative ideas for new cosmetic products is to ask innovative questions. So here's a question for you to ponder. Suppose all the people who use your product suddenly couldn't see color and they couldn't smell fragrances. So color and fragrances, your people who use your products, they don't sense those things. Ask yourself this: how would you differentiate your products from your competitors? Remember, the people who are going to use the products, they can't tell differences with color and with fragrances. So how would your products and formulas have to be different? You should sit down and come up with, say, 10 ideas based on this question, and this might help you come up with some new avenues of thought and new product ideas. Which you could turn into innovative new products. Well, that's all for our show today. We'll be back next week with another show and interview. Just a few quick announcements. The Complete Cosmetic Chemist Training Program is only open for a short time, but you can still get in if you register before September 30th, 2010. I'm going to be emceeing the Midwest SCC's Fall Technical Symposium on October 26th. It's an excellent show about open innovation. So if you're in the Chicagoland area, it's a great opportunity to see how open innovation can be applied to your job or business. So come on out. It's going to be a great show. We're going to have some great speakers. Also, ballots for the national SEC elections should be coming in the mail soon, so be sure to get out there and vote. We have a chance to make this society much more useful to members, and I hope you agree. And if you can vote, that would be greatly appreciated. Finally, if you have any questions and comments about cosmetic science or the show or blog, go to chemistcorner.com and leave your feedback there. Also, feel free to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and connect with us on LinkedIn. Just take a look at the About page on Chemist Corner for more details on following us. All right, that's all I have. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. Now, go make a difference.